have some CFT, or maybe not even CFT, but any QFT, then you want to consider a potential that's coupled to a scalar operator in your theory, where this potential is random in the sense that, of course, that just means there's a distribution probability, the probability distribution for the random probability for the field. And for the simplest case, of course, I just choose it to be Gaussian. That's just to be simple. Then the probability is going to be given by just a Gaussian distribution, right? And then you want to consider your correlators in this theory. Before you average over the random potential, you will just do this, right? Say you would have, you just insert the operator in your, insert that in your path integral. So that will be x. Okay, let me just put it this way. And then you insert the operators, right? And that will be the non-normalized operator, a correlation. But that's not usually what you want to compute in a condensed matter system, especially when you want to average it. If you want to average, before you do the average, you want to make sure that you do the normalized one. That is the proper one that you have to calculate, right? You have to normalize against the partition function. So, and then that's the, that is the normalized correlator without considering, without average being averaged over the random random distribution. So in the end, you really want to compute is this. So that's what you do. You will have to then integrate over all possible potential and multiply by the random distribution, right? So that's very simple. Now, of course, if it's Gaussian, then it already looks like even simpler. So as you see, if there is no such kind of normalization factor here, there will be no need for a replica trick, because that really just looks like a new field theory, except now you have one extra degree of freedom, which is the random potential V, and you can just put that into the action. Except now we are obstructed by this normalization factor, and that is why you need the replica trick. And the replica trick is essentially a trick that allows you to connect normalized correlator to a not normalized correlator. You simply do the following. Let's just replicate all the field to n copies and some integer, okay? And you do the same thing, of course, for everything, then your operator gets replicated as well. Then you just define your new partition function. Called Zn, where it's basically the partition function and copies of the whole thing. So you will just do this path integral, and you will just sum over all possible actions. So sum over all the copies, and then also sum over the copy of the operator. Right? Now, if I want to consider a partition, consider correlators. Typically, that's what I do. I will introduce a current there. Then you find, of course, trivially, if I set n equals 1, that's my original theory. And now if for any arbitrary integer, I just get basically many copies, and so it's just a power law relation, right? So Zn is just u1 to the n. Then the trick is the following. You notice that if I do this, then this is, well, you can also just Let me just continue. And then this is, of course, just this. And then you find that just gets give you this. And so the trick is using this identity, and now I pick the n goes to zero limit, n goes to zero limit, n goes to zero limit. And you find, obviously, in that limit, well, not obvious, but the only thing that's not obvious is that n was supposed to be an integer, and now it continue, and then it continue into a real number. And that is the part that's not so obvious, but just formally, clearly, you get a, what am I writing here? And you see, this is the normalized correlator, right? If you take the derivative of the z1 with respect to the j, it gives you the expectation value for the operator. But because of the log here, it's actually a normalized one. And on this side, however, it is not normalized, right? You just vary the zn with respect to zj. You don't put a log here, and there's a log here. And that allows you to connect the unnormalized ones with the normalized ones. So then here, all you have to do is I do the same thing. I would just now put the limit. Allow me to just work on this thing. So now the operator that I want to compute, I would do it just by take the limit, take the n goes to zero limit, and now inside, inside I will just do the following. Again, I will do this random distribution thing, but I want to replace this part. Yeah, okay. That, you see what I'm trying to do, right? So this part, I will write to change this to be the limit of n goes to zero, then the variations. Instead of taking the variation of this of the original theory, I take the variation of the replicated one. So now I have e to the is. Now I have n copies of them. And also, yeah. No, j is common to everyone.
So it's a common j for everybody, and you're doing multiple derivatives like the j.
That's right. So yes, the only thing is now this is the first derivative. That certainly works out nicely. When you have multiple derivatives, you might worry that, okay, then there's a mixing term. But then when take n goes to zero limit, the mixing term vanishes. Okay. And that you can easily check. Because every time you take a derivative on this guy, you bring down one factor of n. So if you take n goes to zero limit, it is only the one that all the derivatives hit on this guy survive. Right? That's pretty clear. So, and then, therefore, now let me just. So that's what you want to do. Okay. Sorry about this mess. And of course, I also want to take the average over the random potential, right? Multiply together, and now okay. Now, I have to assume that I can take the derivative, change the order of taking derivatives, which I assume that certainly is allowed, and take the n goes to zero limit in the end. And that, of course, well, supposedly reproduce the operator that I wanted to compute in the beginning. So the only difference here is by doing the replicated theory, by putting the replicated theory there, I change the I change the normalized one to unnormalized one. That's the only thing the replica trick does to me. For you. Exactly?
And what you're doing, the thing in front of the integral is just a derivative. I can't quite read the numerator. It's just delta in the end of delta j, delta k, delta
j. Ah, sorry. That's just because I have n operators.
Yeah.
That's all right. So
I'm actually happy with the denominator. The numerator is there's nothing.
Oh, numerator is just the end. Ah, sorry. Sorry.
Okay.
Not j. Yeah, thanks. Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks. So it's very simple. All it does is just to remove the normalization factor here. So that you can squeeze the theory. Now look at this theory. The nice thing is that now it really is just a new Q of t. Except now you have one extra degree of freedom, V, and it has a potential point. That's all. Right? You can combine the two actions together and you get one new theory. And that's the nice part of it. And particularly in this particular case, when V is just a quadratic function, when the potential for V is just a quadratic function, it's really easy. Because now I can simply integrate out V first. It doesn't really have any dynamics of it. So all it does in the end, of course, I still have n copies. That is the problem. But otherwise, it's all OK. And then just I have a sum of the copies. Now, instead of having the potential V that coupled to O, I just integrate it on. And therefore, integrate out V and just end up with a quadratic function for the rest of it. That's coupled to. In this form, I don't have any random potential anymore. I just integrate it out. Right? Used to be the V couples to all the copies of O, and this guy has a quadratic distribution. And now, using the replica trick, I basically move that distribution into the action and combine everything and integrate out V first, and identify with quadratic deformation to the original theory. So that's what the replica trick does. And basically, in the Gaussian, not in the Gaussian distribution, in the case when the distribution is just Gaussian, and it's really simple. All it does is it just introduces a quadratic deformation to your theory, and that's all. Except, of course, you have to have n copies of it. Sorry?
F is in the
boundary. Your quadratic term at the end.
F is downstairs. You are right, PD. Then I want to put F in the downstairs early. Okay. It's just because I'm aiming at this, you're right. And then I should start with F in the downstairs.
So F goes to zero is the.
Well, F goes to zero is to be a delta function distribution. Yeah, that's right. Delta then is not in. Yes. Okay. So that's the replica trick in the normal setup. Now, I just have to briefly mention how you incorporate that in the ADS-CFT language. So this, well, is kind of hand-waving now. So, but basically, what you want to do, of course, first, there are two things you have to do. First of all, you have to replicate your theory. So you have n copies of ADS, and they couple along the boundary. So there's something you have to worry about, the gravitons and things like that. But you can work it out simply because they couples this way. If I don't have that coupling, I simply just have n disconnected ADS space, each one for each of these theory. Once I have the coupling, there's only one energy momentum tensor that remains conserved, right? Initially, I have basically n copy of them. Now, once I couple them, there's only one energy momentum tensor that remains conserved. And therefore, the graviton, it does initially have n copy of graviton, they couple on the boundary, and in the end, only one linear combination of them remains massless. Otherwise, other gravitons become massive. So if I, at least at the leading order, I would not have to worry about the fact there's n copies of ADS. Rather, I just work in the one copy of ADS. That would be sufficient because there's really only one dynamical gravity there. That's one thing you have to do. Of course, then you have to replicate all the field that you to your operator. Well, I have to save some time. But so anyway, so for each operator O, there is a corresponding scalar in the dual space, right? That is the ADS CFT language. Of course, then you will have to replicate the copies as well in ADS. That is one thing you have to do. And then the other thing is you have to incorporate the quadratic deformation into it. And the way you incorporate quadratic deformation is the following. Okay, let me, since I'm talking about these ADS, first of all, that will be the metric I'm going to use. So at z equals 0, that will be my boundary. And z equals to infinity is going to be my horizon, ADS horizon. Okay. So the ADS ADS CFT correspondence basically is that the field phi in the scalar, in the bulk, when it approaches the boundary, basically it behaves this way. Right? You basically have two independent solutions, and they basically both are parallel when it approaches z equals to zero boundary. So the original, without the deformation, the original prescription is simply, so the operator couples to the field phi on the boundary. So from the CFT side, what you consider this field, the value of the phi on the boundary as a source that couples to the operator, and you vary the partition function with respect to the source, and then you take the source to zero, and then you get the correlator as you normally do. From the CFT side, you find the classical solutions for phi in the bulk, and then you express the action as effective action for the theory on the boundary, and then you also vary the action with respect to the boundary value. In this particular case, the boundary value will just be alpha, because suppose one of them dominates, and then that will just be the boundary value. And again, you will set the boundary value to zero in the end, and you vary the action and then set the boundary value to zero in the end, and you get the, so effectively what you end up with that you identify, well, if you work out the effective action, you find that if you vary the action with respect to alpha, you really just get beta. And so beta is really just identified to the correlator, expectation value for your operator O. So the, okay, by the way, I should give you the reference. If you care for a more detailed explanation to this, I think this initially proposed by Witten. And there's another guy I forgot, actually, almost at the same time. I have to apologize to this, to the other guy. But more detailed explanation for the particular for this particular setup using the replica trick, I think was this bunch of people. And the idea is basically you use this relation, and you now basically what you do is effectively you add on the boundary, the boundary theory for phi now gets performed as a quadratic term that's given by beta, because beta is basically identified to the correlation, the expectation value of one. So if you add that particular, add that deformation to the boundary effective action for phi, you find what the net effect is that instead of changing, so here, in the standard ADS CFT correspondence, you identify beta to the expectation value for the operator it used to, and you set the boundary condition that alpha goes to zero for the field phi. That's the boundary condition for phi, so that the variation will give you a, well, I know, the variation of the principle is well defined. So the moment you add this quadratic deformation, this relation gets modified in the following way. Essentially, you still identify beta to the expectation value for the operator O, but you modify the boundary condition for your scalar field, which is basically verify this one. So that's all you need to do in ADS. So this is the key. So the moment I have a double trace deformation in the CFT, the key issue is that the corresponding scalar in the bulk has a mixed boundary. It's nor a deletion nor a Neumann boundary condition, but it's a mixed one. Okay. All right. So that's all I need to do, to tell you about the replica trick and its how you incorporate that in the ADS. Now, what is the question we wanted to ask initially? At least that's what the initial question we wanted to ask. How can I get this thing down? No, I can't. Okay, anyway. So we wanted to compute the current correlation in the CFT side. Because the intuition is the moment you introduce random potential in the theory, you will find some dissipation. If there's dissipation, there's some imaginary part of the current correlator. And that will be giving us some finite number for the DC conductivity. And so that was the idea. But you already see in this language that it's not going to be not going to come in the leading order contribution, because all your random potential couples is to a scalar operator. So it does not couple to a vector in the CFT directly. But therefore, the leading order, that's actually not going to, you will not see any, see this kind of random potential there. And you can also easily see from the ADS side, because on the ADS side, what this gives you at the leading order is just a gauge boundary to boundary correlator. And here is a U1 gauge view in the bulk. But I already told you all the quadratic deformation does is to change the boundary condition for your scalar field that due to the operator O. So you have not done anything to the gauge field in the bulk. Therefore, at the leading order, you just get whatever you had before. There's no correction to it whatsoever. And the only hope that you might have any correction to this guy is to consider a loop correction where you have a phi runs in the loop. Right? That is the first one you want to look for. And that was the motivation for the topic of this talk. You want to consider, you have to consider a loop correction in the log. Leading order in large N expansion. In the field theory side, why is it large N? First of all, this is already, I don't know, do you have any? Yeah, but why is it large N? I think that's because this, that has something to do with, this is a double trace definition already, right?
That's true.
So being a double trace, I think it can only contribute at less to leading order. That was basically building in this deformation. Right? You can, how can you incorporate a double trace operator in the by one without going to non-planar limit, I think.
So do you require some special properties in your CFT?
The special property is simply, I don't require any special property in CFT, but the specialty is the assumption that the random potential coupled to a trace. I think that is the only assumption. I don't think you need any other assumptions for the CFT. The moment you consider this kind of deformation that leads to a double trace deformation, already I don't think you can see in the planar limits, right?
But I guess the fact that three diagrams in the bulk does not give any dissipation.
That's right. The tree diagram, as I said, if you're looking for the current correlator, if the tree level is just a tree level correlation for the gauge view, it has nothing to do with the scale view itself. And all it does is to change the boundary condition for the scale. Right? All this whole thing does is changing the boundary condition for the for this gate too. So at the tree level, there's no way you can see this kind of presence, the presence of the W-H. So from AD side, it's pretty clear. And I think from the CFT side, it's also clear, it's just because it's a double trace definition. Okay.
What role is some level, just if you have having a scalar loop, if you just bring that in to get the dissipation, what role is the replica trick play? Why do you need
any scales? Yes. Okay. First of all, if there's no definition, the theory is completely a conformal field theory, right? You do not break the conformality there. Therefore, what you will find is the DC conductivity is just a delta function. Is that right? At zero. Yeah, without charge density, we just
everything just goes like power law.
Yeah. So. Right. There's no imaginary part, right? Are we sure there's no? I think there is no imaginary part.
The power law is a function of frequency.
Function of the frequency, yeah. The incoming frequency. Yeah. It's going to be boring, basically. And the moment you introduce deformation, one thing I forgot to mention is clearly you already break a conformality because this f actually has a dimension. The f is a dimension-full parameter. So you immediately introduce the dimension in the theory. So that's that, therefore, you hope that you see something interesting.
It seems like the only for deformation just changed your boundary condition for phi.
That's right.
And so why is that playing such an important role
in the loop diagram?
It changes the propagator.
Yeah, it does change the propagator. I'm just trying. You change the propagator, but yeah, because to be honest with you, that we do not know the absolute value for the imaginary part of the loop. Therefore, I'm not sure. Is it supposed to be zero or not zero? Not zero. Or just number. In the case when f goes to zero. With the finite number, we cannot predict. That's the problem. But when there's f that's non-zero, you can see that the DC conductance changes with respect to f, just because the propagator depends on them. The variation we can see, but I cannot predict the absolute value, so that's why it's not so easy to answer your question. But you can, as I was sure that once you have the F introduced into the theory, the DC conductivity does depend on them. It varies. And the question you are asking is, what about the conformal limit? And that is the limit things diverge. So, we have a divergence in that limit.
So I'm a little bit confused. So
yes.
From field theory point of view, isn't that double trace deformation is still important in the strict n equal infinity limit?
Repeat the question.
Yes, but that is only when you consider the scalar correlators, right? For example, if you consider the scalar correlators, then at the tree level, you already see because they correspond to the bulk-to-bulk correlator for phi. That you see at the tree level already. The point is you have to couple this double trace to a vector current.
I understand, but from the field theory point of view, so random potential in the double trace operator is still important.
To the scalar correlation.
Yeah, even in the larger limit.
Yes.
Yet, current doesn't dissipate. In the strict line.
Yeah, that seems to be the case.
That's a little strange.
But from ADS side, isn't that obvious that you don't change the boundary condition for your scale?
Yeah, from what point?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So in the CFT side, I don't have a better way to convince you. But, yeah, I know, there's a little bit strange, but there's also an obvious contradiction.
When you started, you just had ADS space and there was no scalar. When you go to this new vacuum or with the double trace operator, yes. does Should I think that phi has a non-trivial profile in the background?
No, it's zero. It changes boundary conditions.
Yeah. So you're saying it's still a conformal field theory?
No. The boundary condition is conformal. Oh, you're saying the vacuum is.
I think you might want to say that the profile is suppressed, but I don't know.
Yeah, we treat it as the propagator changes. It must.
So you worry that the vacuum seems to be still conformal.
But I could consider back reaction of all the scalar. I think it would back react and change the geometry if I consider back reaction.
But what would be back reacting if it was back reacting? There should have been a profile.
It's probably also in the Lagrangian limit.
But I think it was it back reacts only in the loop.
Yeah.
At tree level, it's just a change in boundary conditions.
That
so you could say that at tree level, the vacuum is conformal. That there are loop back reactions.
You can sort of see that this is the only leading order prescription, because basically what you get is that you're saying instead of having the deformation here, I just simply replace this by the Cartesian values. That's basically what this prescription does, right? How can you change that the operator directly by data on the boundary? Basically, you're saying all the QFT that I'm computing in the deformed CFT, well, it's not CFT anymore, is given by this. And what you did really, the trick what you did is actually change this. Replace this factor by the vacuum expectation value. So it's probably only in the Lagrangian limit. The proposal basically is just saying this factor I changed that by vacuum expectation value. That's why in the EDS side, the effective action gets replaced by this. So it's true that probably introduced including the back reaction element. But it will not matter to us anymore anyway, because even at the, that would be the next to the leading order to the propagator for phi. That would be the sub-leading contribution. Further sub-leading contribution.
Does that mean you're taking alpha equals beta equals zero when you're?
Yes. The fact that
so what kind of, in order to get the dissipation to the tree, at the tree level, so what kind of deformation should I add to the theory? Like random potential in column squared, something like that.
Is what square, sorry?
I'm just thinking whether one has to add some.
Yeah, you have to somehow couple to the column directly.
One can construct some scalar operator out of column. Right?
I see. You take a derivative on it. Yeah.
Or column square.
What's column square?
Inner product.
Oh, column square. The column. I see. Yeah, so again, it's basically directly coupled to some vector, right?
Then do you expect the dissipation at the tree level?
At the deformation, then if you direct, if the prescription is correct that you would basically change the boundary condition for the gauge field, then yes. But I haven't thought about that, okay. Yeah, just naively, it seems like by analogy. Yeah.
And then
I don't know. But in the interest of time, let me go to the main part of the talk. Otherwise, I just don't run on this issue for too long. Because that's not really the main body of the work is on the window diagram that we have interest. So this in any way, you can think of it even from a few theory. From the few theory side already, that's something interesting because. Well, it's just a one loop is a very general question. That's how I got involved in this problem because initially I thought it would be easy, right? Because it's just a one loop calculation. And how difficult can that be? It's actually not that difficult, except there's some divergence that's really bothering us. That's what I want to introduce, explain to you. Okay, so that will go to the next part of the talk. So I explain the propagator, the loop, and the Kaczorowski. So the propagator for the gauge field A is pretty standard because I have not done anything to it. But what I need is a boundary to bulk propagator. I just give you, so I will not write down the details. Sorry?
No. It's all pure ideas. So that's also part of the limitation of this calculation. It's all in the pure ideas.
But does that mean that you say there's no chemical potential in Dichter? Is that part of why you're not going to have chemical potential?
I will mention that. Yeah. In fact, if you really care about the real participation in the real condensed system, you have to deal with one issue. The next step, the other next step
is to consider black hole solution. But that's just become a bit more nasty. So the propagator is, okay, I'm in the D plus one dimension now. So in the Euclidean signature, you would just put PZ there. And then for the Lorentzian signature, because we're really interested in the real-time dynamics, you go to the Lorentzian signature, then you can just weak rotate it. You get an I in front of it. Except now you have to be a little bit careful because now we're doing a closed-time formalism. So for one of the legs, you choose the incoming boundary condition, and the other one, you have to choose the outgoing boundary condition. So then the one of the legs have to be the complex conjugate of it, and which just corresponding to put a minus sign there. You can get either by weak rotation. That just depends on the contour you choose. That's the ambiguity, and that have to be fixed by boundary condition. Now, the interesting part is the propagator for phi. The propagator for phi I need is a bulk to bulk propagator. It goes from z1 to z2. In the Euclidean signature, usually. Now, let me first turn off the deformation. If I turn off the deformation. The propagator in the usual, again, it's proportional. I don't care about the overall constant in this talk. It's usually written as this. And there's a zeta function, which just means this term vanishes if z1 is smaller than z2. And then you exchange z1 and z2. So for if you want to consider the Lorentzian signature, you can just weak rotate this thing. But we find this not very convenient to use for various reasons you will see. So instead, we write this propagator in the integral form as the following. By the way, I forgot to explain. So the nu here, of course, is the standard thing. Where m is the mass of the phi. The scalar field, and k and I are corresponding Bessel functions. Modified Bessel function, I don't know. Whatever, one of the Bessel functions, you know, the standard notation. But we find it's more convenient to write in the following way. This is the case when the deformation is turned off. So I have the standard J nu, which basically corresponding to setting the boundary condition alpha goes to zero then. This is now I call the PO. So in this, so I would just write P here instead. And this propagator you can derive it in many ways. And the simplest way is that do the standard thing. That is, if you look at the kinetic term for your field scalar, field phi. As usual, the story is that splits into the flat space piece and the piece that contains z derivatives. And the flat space piece, you go to the Fourier mode, you get k squared. That's basically p squared. That's basically what this p squared is. And then you end up with a part of some z derivative. Right? Something like schematically this way. And then you solve the eigenvalue problem for this guy. And the eigenvalue is basically lambda. Okay? And then you expand the mode. So the eigenmodes are this, basically. Lambda is the eigenvalue as a saying. And that is the flat space piece. So this is the flat space piece, and this is the z-directional piece. And then you just plug that, just expand your field phi in terms of the mode, and put that back into the kinetic action, and you find the action just becomes this. Well, this is the expansion parameters. So of course, you just invert that. That gives you the propagator with all these things. And now you want a Fourier, Bessel Fourier transform back in z coordinate. So you just stick it in the modes in there and integrate over the possible eigenvalues. And that gives you the propagator. You can check that the propagator agrees with this, although it takes you need to choose the contour for this integral careful as smart so that you can show that in fact the two equal. And that's in our in the appendix of our paper. But why do I like this propagator? Is it for many reasons? The first thing is that it makes you know now it's very easy to generalize it to mixing boundary conditions. To generalize this to mixing boundary conditions, all you have to do is just to change the boundary condition for your mode, right? That's all you have to do. So instead of putting the J nu there, which is the standard boundary condition corresponding to alpha goes to zero, you just choose the corresponding correct mode there, which is defined as the following. Because this eigenfunction always has two independent solutions, which usually is, you can choose as J nu and J minus nu. You just have to linear combine them, where you end up with some coefficient here. This B is just 2 lambda times, 2 nu. There's a gamma function. And this N is just normalization factor, because you want to make sure that the mode is orthonormal, right? So that's all you need to do, and then you just end up with having a normalization factor, non-trivial factor there. So the moment you change the boundary condition, all you need to do is just fix this boundary condition here. Nothing else changes. Okay? So just change the mode, which is mixed. And from there, already you see the dimension of phi is basically 2 nu. That's the first thing that's the advantage of it. The second advantage of this propagator is that now the pole structure is very clear. For example, if you're looking for the Feynman propagator, then all you need to do is just do the standard story, put I epsilon prescription there. Now you can change the order of integral. If you integrate k0 first, and take care of the pole carefully, you get Feynman propagator in the standard way. Or you can integrate out lambda first. Okay? As long as you choose the contour continuously without crossing anything, you get a different representation. But that's equally well. But if you want to go to the, so in our case, because we're looking at closed time loop, closed time formalism, we really need to have one of the leg is advanced propagator and the other leg is a retarded propagator. But that, for that, it's also very easy. Nothing really changes. It all changes is just the post prescription to that property. You want to put two posts on one side of the real axis or the other side of the axis. That's all you need to do, right? So other than the pole prescription, there's no difference, at least at the zero temperature case. This is the pure ADS case. If you go to black hole, there's additional factor that you have to take into account. Then the third one is, now this thing is really convenient if you're looking for the imaginary part of the loop. Remember, our motivation was to looking at the imaginary part of the loop. So we want to derive some kind of counterpart of Kutkowski rule or to me optical theorem in the flat space time. In ADS, naively, there isn't such a thing because there is no translational symmetry along this direction. So it's not trivial to derive it. But once you write the propagator in this language, it's immediately obvious. And that is the thing that I'm going, that's the topic that I'll tell you now. So let me now write down the loop integral for you in term of these propagators. So the I just put this a little bit lower. Okay. So the loop, there's some one loop correction to this current correlator proportional. Again, I just ignore all the overall numerical factors. I explained this formula to you after I finished writing it. Essentially, this is the two propagators. And there's some tensorial structure that I have omitted, but you can work it out easily. That is the standard thing. Now, what you see is these are basically the two propagators, which I have written. Oh, where is it? Here. Okay, these are the propagators. And also these two factors also that was in the propagator. And this is just a tensorial structure, but I have to integrate over all possible value of lambda. But there is a function I, which is defined this way. You see, I come seeing simply because then if I plug this back into the loop integral, for each propagator, I have a factor of j, and for the external photon, I have a factor of k. So if you glue them all together and integrate over the z from 0 to infinity, and you have this factor I, right, in the loop. So now, if I stare at this integral, the interpretation is very clear. Because I can now think of this in the 4D language. And it's not very surprising, because basically what I've done is I expand the mode in its eigen mode. So from 4D point of view, I have a continuous tower of KK scalars. And for each scalar, this lambda effectively acts as its mass. So this lambda, you can think of this eigenvalue for Z in Z direction, you can think of it as the mass of the KK scalar. So this is almost exactly like the standard form in the flat space calculation, where you have a continuous tower of KK mode that has mass lambda 1 and lambda 2, which goes from 0 to infinity. The only thing that has the memory that it was in ADS is incorporated in this function I, which is, from the 4D point of view, is just a vertex between the photon and the 2KK scalar, right? So in this language, now if you ask myself, you ask yourself, what is the imagined part of this? That is standard thing, because essentially it's just this optical theorem in flat space-time. All you need to do is to remember you have a continuous KK tolerance. So the imagined part of this loop, is essentially all you need to do is just to remember you have this mass, and then the amplitude of this. A single scalar decays to 2 phi, single vector decays into 2 phi with mass lambda 1, lambda 2. The amplitude of it, integral over. Right? That's just the standard optical theorem, except now in this case, you have to remember you have a tower of lambda 1 and lambda 2 to integrate over. And this ADS information is incorporated in the vertex function I here. Okay? And so then you can just go ahead and evaluate it. Because basically this thing, what this thing says is rather than putting two propagators here, you just remove them by two delta functions, right? You put the particles on shell and integrate all possible phase volume. That's all you need to do. And so the final form for the imagined part of the loop is really very simple. Okay. So the imagined part of this thing now is really simple. You don't need to. You just get rid of the two propagators and replace them by the delta function. Put the particles into intermediate particles on shell. And do the K integral, the momentum integral. And that's it. That's the answer. So at this form, at this stage, it looks really simple. Here, I just have a function H, which is the phase volume factor. You can guess one. Right. Okay? The phase volume factor appears simply because that simply because when you put particles on shell, there's only a finite range of momentum that you can choose. Basically, it's the volume of the sphere where the momentum can take its value. Right? So basically, that's it. And at this point, it seems to be very simple, and the problem is solved, basically. Except now, we have to worry about this function I. All you need to do is to figure out what the function I is. The function I is just defined here. So let me quickly go to the very last part of the talk. I will explain to you the function of I. It looks naive. Unfortunately, there's some problem there. So the last part of the talk. So it's not bad. Good. Bad. Or maybe not so bad. This part I have question mark. So it's all about this vertex function right now. The first bad is very easy, very quick. The first time you look at this function, you think it's bad, because what you have three Bessel functions multiplied by a power function, and you want to integrate from 0 to infinity. This is hopeless. There's no way you can evaluate this analytically. And also, even if you want to do it numerically, it's going to be a problem. Because it goes into 0 infinity, the integral, also the integrand oscillates crazily at large z. Okay, so there's no hope to have a good numerical calculation at all. at very large z, this function is just hopeless. So so the first side is bad. Okay, bad. But thanks to the amazing searching power of my collaborator, it becomes a good thing. Because somehow she discovered that mathematicians have already evaluated this function in the most general form, long time ago. You put any numbers you wish here, 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 any numbers you wish. And it's evaluated, and the answer is known, which is written in terms of the so-called generalized hypergeometrical function. So this I, let me, I forgot to mention one thing here, that I have, the moment I write the imaginary part in this way, you see I integrate from 0 to 1 here. 1 comes in, but after I rescale everything, because here everything is measured in the unit of p. So I can, what I do is I set p to be 1. That's going to be my unit. Then everything else that has dimension is scaled in the same way. So, right. So all the other things scaled with respect to p. And that's why I write integral as from 0 to 1. So I absorb the dimension basically by p. Okay, so that's a small thing. Therefore, I only, you know, I always put this thing to be 1 or I. Depends on whether you're Euclidean signature or you're Lorentzian signature, you put either 1 or I here. Again, I ignore the numeral factors. And then this one I just write 1. It doesn't really matter. Just to give you a feeling of it. So this F4 is so-called the generalized hypergeometrical function or the apple function. Like hypergeometrical function, it depends on various parameters. So these are the parameters it depends on. But it is generalized in the sense that it depends on 2 variables, okay, instead of 1 variable, which is lambda 1 and lambda 2 squared in this case. And this function is known in the sense that you have a serious expansion point. So this function do have a serious expansion. It's a double expansion now because it depends on 2 parameters, 2 variables. And this number is complicated, but we don't really care. So that is good. Okay. Given that serious expansion, even if you cannot do it numerically, analytically, you can do it numerically without too much of a problem. Okay. So at this point, it seems to be good. Then the bad thing comes again. That is, this thing only, this power series is only convergent in the range that this is smaller than 1. The absolute value had to be smaller than 1. Initially, I thought, okay, this is actually very nice. The fact that 1 is something special is a reasonable thing. Because physically, if you look at this diagram from 4D point of view, this integral supposedly vanishes at lambda 1 plus lambda 2 equals p. Because that's basically the energy conservation that tells you. If lambda 1 and lambda 2 add up larger than p, such a decay process is impossible, right? So 1 is a boundary case is reasonable. What is very strange is that diverge thing, okay? If it doesn't diverge fast enough, it is still okay. Because remember, there's a phase volume factor here. The phase volume simply tells you that when you add a boundary case, the momentum can go nowhere, right? It just shrinks to a point. Essentially, in the rest frame of this particle, it just sits there and split and go nowhere. So there's no phase volume for that guy. And therefore, if this guy doesn't diverge too badly, it will be still all right. In fact, but in the mathematical literature, unfortunately, it is only says that, it's only said that this thing diverged. Okay, but it wasn't said how it diverges. And so the problem we have to figure out how it diverges. And to figure out how it diverges, it turns out it's actually to be it's actually a simple thing. All you need to do is to stare at this its definition. Because if you stare at this definition, you find the only chance this function can diverge is when the integral is taken to infinity. Because if you only do a finite range integral, everything here is analytic function, and there's no pose whatsoever, except maybe at z equals 0, but we take care of that. And so the whole thing do not have any chance of diverging, right? Unless you take this take integral to really to infinity, then you might end up with seeing something tricky. So all you need to do is to discover, to find how the integrand behaves at very large z. And that you can do very easily. Because being Bessel functions inside, it removed the phase volume factor, the beautiful formula, which I will need. Anyway, just look at inside, and it's the asymptotic expansion is trivial. Well, simple. Let me put an I here now. I want to consider I. Let me also set P to be 1. As I said, I can scale everything such that the incoming energy is 1. And then it's very easy. This guy asymptotically just an oscillatory function. There's a factor of z I will take care of later. And this guy is a cosine function plus some phase, which doesn't really quite matter for the large z behavior. There's some other phase. But the cosine of course is just a sum of two exponentials. So you have three factors multiplied together. And there are some factor of z, I think is z minus 3/2. So at a very large z, the behavior of this integrand is basically the following. You have all possible combination plus minus. 1 plus minus lambda 1 plus minus lambda 2. Z plus some phase factor that you don't care. Okay? Then you can see precisely why, when the sum of them equals to 1, this integrand diverges. Because precisely in that case, one of the branch will have no oscillatory factor. If there's no oscillatory factor, you end up with a z to the positive power, and that's diverged. When there is oscillatory power factor there, you can always regularize the integral to give you a final answer. And so that's precisely the reason this power series diverges exactly on the boundary when the sum up to be 1. So you have all possible choices for the signs of them. It doesn't matter. All of them will give you a zero frequency branch there. So that is just, okay, so that's the leading order. And you can go ahead to the next, to the leading order and so on. You just have to work out the asymptotic expansion for the Bessel function to the next order and then next order. And you just you write down the asymptotic form of the expansion and do the integral there. That will give you a serious expansion for your for the singularity. In the interest of time, given the fact there's no time anymore, I just give you the final answer. Yeah. You know what? I want write down two formula, and two long formula, and then that's it. So, yeah. I want to keep this. We haven't reached the bad part yet. Oh, there we already. Oh no. Okay, let me just write it down. Now they will they'll combine. Huh. Okay. So you go ahead and write down the asymptotic expansion for your integrand, and you integrate things there. You find in, a series expansion for this I function near each singularities. In particular, this one, this expansion, is focused near the singularity when this guy is zero. Okay, you have all other singularities, but effectively, and they are all actually nicely related in the end due, through some kind of interesting sort of like duality transformation that I don't have time to go there, but they are basically all the singularities are the same. So I can focus on this one particularly, which is also the one that matters to us when we compute the imaginary part. So the upshot is, if I look at the divergence here, the first thing, the first information is this thing is bad, because the divergence goes like 1 over q, 1 over xq. That is bad, because the phase volume factor I have earlier, I already removed it. In the case, in the 4 plus 1 case, shrinks to 0 as power of 3/2. Okay, so that's not sufficient to suppress this divergence. So this divergence is a bad thing. And also the next leading order divergence is also a bad thing because it's 1 over squared. Interestingly, the immediate next one is precisely 1 over 3/2. And so this part is actually all right. That part multiplied by the phase volume factor is going to give me something finite. All right? So that's the bad part, is that the leading divergence is too divergent. Okay, too badly divergent. But if you work things out more carefully, it might not be that bad. Because, you see, if I look at this thing, the leading divergence does depend on the boundary condition F. But the dependence on F goes into a phase, which is I call theta F, that is defined this way. So this angle do depend on F. But it goes into the phase here. And therefore, if I'm looking at the modulus squared of it, the leading order divergence is actually universal. It is completely independent to anything, independent to the mass of the particle, independent to the boundary condition you choose for it. So this part is completely universal. It's just a number. Seems like you can regularize it easily. Simply, a polyvilla will do it, for example. Just subtract another particle that will do it. The next to the leading order one is not so good. It does depend on nu, which translates to the mass of the scalar in the bulk. But the good thing about that is it also independent of F, right? Which also comes in as the consequence that this guy, if you take the modulus of this guy, this part is going to disappear. But unfortunately, there's crossing terms that comes in here. This guy is dependent on everything, okay? It does depend on F. F and U. So it looks like if I'm comparing a system with different random disorder, then I can find some finite answer. Because now these two terms are always get subtracted, and I end up with something that is finite. This term multiplied by the phase volume precisely do not diverge when you approach the boundary. So that's what we did. And this is the not-so-bad part of the story that remains not very conclusive, I have to admit, that because we don't completely understand what happens to the two leading divergences. So this is still remain an open question, especially if you want to compute the real Feynman diagram in the bulk, and there's really a problem. Especially this guy. I think this guy is probably okay because it doesn't depend on anything. It's totally universal. But this guy does depend on the mass of the particle. It's a little bit more puzzling. The fortunate thing is, of course, that the thing that depends on F is actually finite. So that is the thing we did in the paper. What we did is we compare systems with different random disorder. And then when you do the subtraction, you find a finite answer. And the final answer, it's expected, but of course, the downside of this thing is that we cannot predict the absolute value for the DC conductivity. All you can predict is how it changes with respect to F. And that is something that you expected. It goes to some constant we don't know, as I said. Subtract to a number that you can compute, either numerically or analytically. Depends on the maybe you go to lower dimension, there's hope to analytic may continue calculate it. But there's a number you can compute. Roughly, it goes like one constant subtract minus F squared. So that is expected. When you have more disorder, the DC conductivity decreases. Yeah, as I said, I don't know, because when F equals zero, the absolute value I cannot predict. Because of the divergence that plagued the whole story.
Physically, we expect.
Why zero?
When F is zero.
Is that? Yeah. But for frequency. Ah, okay. But this is the zero frequency then? Ah, okay. Yeah, then it's, that's right. In that case, yes. It's a power form. No, zero. It's a power law of P, right?
I mean, for finite frequency, but finite frequency goes to zero.
Yeah. Then it's zero. So, yes, so that's the end of the story. Thanks for your attention.